Before we continue with the readings, I was wondering if there are any questions left over from this morning? Yes. Well, the Buddha says if you try to pin down specific relationships, you go crazy, but the general principle holds that where there's suffering, there have been some unskillful actions. Now, the fact that a group of people tend to be born together and then have to suffer a particular thing that happens to that group, that they may not have been in that group previously, they may come from other places, but they have that type of karma in common, and that's what brings groups of people together. Verbal conduct, misconduct, and good conduct actually speak to the words you actually say, whereas verbal fabrication is you're thinking in the mind in preparation to say something. That's verbal fabrication. Okay, we're continuing on this passage, number 4. I said I would discuss the mental actions. It makes more sense to discuss them under the heading of skillful mental actions, so skip down to that section. So skillful mental actions, the first one, you're not covetous. You don't covet the belongings of others, thinking, that what belongs to others would be mine. You bear no ill will, and you're not corrupt in the resolves of your heart. You think, may these beings be free from animosity, free from oppression, free from trouble, and may they look after themselves with ease. This is the basic phrase for wishing goodwill to beings at large. And one of the more interesting passages in there is, sections in there is that may they look after themselves with ease. You realize that for beings to be happy, it's not just something you're going to be doing for them. They have to learn how to develop the skills where they can look after themselves. And that's your wish. And I must admit, I would much rather be in a position where I can look after myself rather than having people look after me. So you're wishing people not only to be happy, but also to be able to provide the causes for happiness inside themselves. And then finally, with right view, you're not warped in the way you see things. There is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. And that sounds kind of strange. You say, well, of course, there's what's given. But in the time of the Buddha, that was actually a controversial topic. This is based on the fact that for millennia, the Brahmins had been talking about the virtue of giving to Brahmins. And saying, in fact, they actually had a ceremony that for making merit for dead ancestors, where at one part of the ceremony is written into the ceremony, the Brahmins turn to the sponsors and say, we are speaking in the voice of your relatives, give to the Brahmins. And then after they gave, then the next part of the script was, give more. It's not enough. You can imagine after a couple of millennia of this, people had a reaction. And so some of the anti-Brahmanical schools that came up taught that there was not what was given, what is offered. In other words, there was no virtue to giving, is what they're saying. And they would give two arguments for that. One was that everything is predetermined. Therefore, people don't have a choice. If someone is giving, it's not because of goodness of their heart. It was just that the way the atoms of the world worked out that they were going to give. Another argument against it was saying that people have there's nothing there that survives death, so that when a person dies, that's it. Therefore, why bother giving to something that's just going to disappear? And so when the Buddha was saying there is what is given, and this is basically his definition of what's called mundane right view, he's saying, one, things are not totally predetermined, that we do have our choices, and therefore there is virtue in giving. And secondly, there is something about a human being that goes beyond death. And so giving to a human being actually can have long-term consequences. So those are the implications of those sentences. That the fruits and rewards of good and bad actions, that's basically the principle of karma. There is this world and the next world, that's the principle of rebirth. There is mother and father. Again, this sounds obvious, but again, if you teach that things are totally predetermined, then the things that your parents did for you, you don't have any gratitude because they couldn't help themselves. They just did it. Whereas if you teach that parents do have, you know, we all have freedom of choice, the fact that the parents chose to raise you, they didn't throw you out as soon as you came out, or as soon as you got difficult, they kept with you, and therefore, you know, they owe you, you owe them a debt of gratitude. Finally, with spontaneously reborn beings, those are the beings born in heaven and hell and the hungry ghosts, and their contemplatives and Brahmins who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next, after having directly known and realized it themselves. So that's basically mundane right view. Any questions on those lists of skillful and unskillful actions? Yes. Okay, that's basically, there are three levels of giving, and sacrifice was basically the verb they use for big gifts, large gifts, and there's a sutta where the Buddha talks about, you know, skillful and unskillful sacrifices. And unskillful sacrifices, say you sacrifice a horse, you sacrifice an animal. Skillful sacrifices are when you make a large gift to virtuous people. That would be a skillful sacrifice. Mm-hmm.
The skillful verbal action,
mm-hmm. Basically at the right time in the right place. If you have something critical to say to somebody, you don't say it right in front of a lot of people. You write, you know, get them in a good mood, you get them off to a quiet corner, and then you politely let them have it. But when you figure out what's the right time and place, basically. Yes? Heaven, hell, and the hungry ghosts. They don't have parents. They just, they appear. Although apparently some devas actually have kids. There's a passage in the canon where this deva is living in a tree with her kids. And both metaphorically and real. And it's, you know, if you don't meet up with them in your meditation, that's okay. But there are some people who will meet up with them in meditation. It's good to know. I have a student, another Canadian, who started doing meditation on his own when he was a teenager. And he was raised Catholic. Now, if you're a Catholic, the world has only two types of beings. There are demons and angels. And he saw these beings in his meditation. And he realized there are quite a lot of them around where he was, Saskatchewan. And I wouldn't be surprised if Vancouver Island has quite a few too. You know? And they obviously weren't angels, and it freaked him out. Because for him, the only alternative was that they were demons. Whereas if you have a cosmology that explains, there are many other levels of being, and they're not necessarily malicious, they're just suffering. It helps you deal with them more intelligently and deal with the experience more intelligently. So, to get back to the deva in the tree, this monk just wanted to cut down the tree to make a hut. And so the deva comes down and says, you know, please don't destroy my house to build your house. And the monk ignores her. And so when he cuts down the tree, it hits the arms of her two children and injures them. And her first thought is, what if I kill this monk? And then her second thought was, no, it would be good to kill him. I'm going to go tell the Buddha. So she goes tell the Buddha. And it's one of the few rules that we have that were instigated by devas. We can't cut living beings, can't cut plants. While I'm on the topic, one more story about devas and trees. We had a storm come through the monastery one time and knocked down a lot of limbs and things from trees. And the day after the storm, we were walking through the monastery with John Fuang and me, kind of looking at the damage. We came to this one spot where this large limb had been knocked off of a mango tree and had just pinned this papaya tree to the ground. And I don't know if you know papaya trees. I mean, they're almost nothing. I mean, there's no hardwood or anything to them. They're just spindly little things with papayas at the top. They're just pinned down to the ground. And he looked at it. He said, well, that's what you get for living in a papaya tree. He didn't explain anything more. And what went through my mind was, have you ever seen the Prest Fairy Book? Does anyone here see the Prest Fairy Book? It's supposedly the story of this little girl who goes out in the garden, and these fairies come and play with her, and she's got this little book for pressing flowers, and she just presses the fairies. And so you have all these paintings of squashed fairies, and that was kind of what went through my mind when John Fu made that comment. Yes. No, specifically the one about having right view at the very end. Mm-hmm. Yes.
How can we tell the difference whether we're really seeing everything from another realm or we're just like hallucinating?
Okay, either way, you treat them the same. You treat them the same either way. In other words, you don't give them too much reality, you don't take them too seriously. This is why that section of humor in the book on the Buddha Smiles has a lot of stories about devas. But at the same time, you're good to them, just in case. They could be. Yeah, it could be. Uh-huh. And also, if you learn how to treat beings that appear in your consciousness, real or unreal, kindly, it's a good habit to have. But you do want protection, because some of them come and they're not kindly themselves. So the basic recommendation is you fill your body with good breath energy, you fill your body with good awareness. That's kind of your protection, so they can't invade your space, and then you spread goodwill. Because even if it is, a real deva coming down to tell you something about how to meditate or something, you can't take that as absolutely true. You have to test it. In other words, they give a recommendation. First you compare it with what you know of the Dharma, and if it seems to fit in with the Dharma, then you give it a try. Oh, who knows? Maybe it's a relative from a past lifetime or something. I mean, there are stories in the canon of devas coming down to talk to monks, and if you've ever read any of the stories of the Ajahns in the forest tradition, John Munn had a lot of devas interested in him. So you don't know, your relatives are not only your relatives this time around. And that's for good or for ill. Yes. These are all from the Pali Canon. That's the Theravada texts that record what the Buddha said and what his close disciples said, for the most part. There are some sections of the Pali Canon that seem to be later. I didn't take any of those sections. These come from the parts that seem to be the most reliable. And we have some of the Pali Canon in the back there. There's the volume is called Handful of Leaves. We're eventually planning 4 volumes. 2 have been done already. Okay, passage 5. 3 roots of what is unskillful. So unskillful behavior comes from greed, aversion, or delusion. And the main message that comes from this particular one is that not only does unskillful behavior lead to bad consequences, one of the really bad consequences is that unskillful behavior tends to lead to more unskillful behavior. And then there's kind of a synergy, things get worse and worse. Whatever greedy person fabricates by means of body, speech, or intellect, that too is unskillful. Whatever suffering a greedy person, his mind overcome with greed, his mind consumed, wrongly inflicts on another person through beating or imprisonment or confiscation or placing blame or banishment. This is basically, we're talking about kings and other government types who are with the thought, I have power, I want power. That too is unskillful. Thus it is that many evil, unskillful qualities born of greed, caused by greed, originate through greed, conditioned by greed, come into play. Then it goes beyond that. And a person like this is called one who speaks at the wrong time, speaks what is unfactual, speaks what is irrelevant, speaks contrary to the Dharma, contrary to the Vinaya. The Vinaya is the monastic code. Why? Because of having wrongly inflicted suffering on another person through beating or imprisonment, etc. Then when told what is factual, he denies it and doesn't acknowledge it. In other words, once you've been doing bad things, you don't want to hear about other things. You deny what's factual. that you start not digging into other people's behavior because you're afraid people will start digging into your own behavior. Mm-hmm. Years back, I called this the George Bush effect, but it doesn't make an ardent effort to untangle it to see this is unfactual, this is baseless. That's why a person like this is called one who speaks at the wrong time, speaks what is unfactual, speaks what is irrelevant, contrary to the Dharma and the Vinaya. A person like this, his mind overcome with evil and unskillful qualities born of greed, etc. His mind consumed, dwells in suffering right here and now, threatened, turbulent, feverish, and at the breakout of the body after death can expect a bad destination. So in other words, you start, especially if you want power, things, you start doing things that you shouldn't be doing, and then it makes it more difficult for you yourself to know, okay, what is true, what is false. You get yourself just more and more entangled in unskillful behavior. Any questions on that passage?
It's a related question. There's another sutta that was translated with the unfactual and untrue.
Mm-hmm. Pali has a tendency to just pile on words sometimes. It's basically, if you didn't get the first word, you get the second one. You know that thing that you have to, when you're talking to a group of people, you have to say each thing three times. And so sometimes you vary the words. There is another passage which I didn't include because it's quite long, which talks about the opposite effect, which is that if you are a virtuous person, then the vows you take tend to come true. It's a case where Jitta is, he's a householder, and he's a non-returner. He's quite advanced in his practice, and he's dying. And some devas come to him and say, you know, if you put your mind on becoming a universal monarch, you would be a really good universal monarch. And so he says, no, I don't want that. That too is inconstant. The two can bring suffering. And, of course, the people sitting around Jitta don't see the devas. All they hear is saying, I don't want that. That, too, is inconstant. And they say, come on, get a grip. And he says, no, it's not that I'm losing my grip. I was talking to some devas. Now, of course, here in the West, they say, oh, yeah, it's even worse. But then his relatives say, well, why did the devas want you to make this vow? He says, well, a virtuous person, the vows of a virtuous person do tend to come true. So that the virtue that you have, as that you've developed through observing the precepts, creates a kind of power as the various virtues come together and they strengthen you and strengthen your good karma. Passages 6 and 7 focus on the issue of heedfulness. The first one actually mentions heedfulness directly. Buddha saying, just as the footprints of all legged animals are encompassed by the footprint of the elephant, and the elephant's footprint is reckoned foremost among them in terms of size. In the same way, all skillful qualities are rooted in heedfulness, converge in heedfulness, and heedfulness is reckoned the foremost among them. This is in response to an issue that's many times raised, which is when the Buddha says that, talks about the mind, does he say that we are innately good or innately bad? And the answer is neither. We have potentials for goodness and potentials for evil all within us. And what develops our skillfulness is this quality of heedfulness, seeing that different courses of action have very different results. And if we're not careful about how we act, we can actually create a lot of problems. If we are careful about how we act, we can avoid a lot of problems. That's the beginning of our skillful behavior. And in passage 7, he talks about, he gives some reflections for good behavior. First, there's the recommendation, you reflect on your actions. I'm the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions. That's the point I made just now, that people who tend to have the same types of actions in their background tend to be born related to one another. Okay. And have my actions as my arbitrator. In other words, it's your actions who decide where you're going to go. Whatever I do for good or for evil, to that will I fall heir. Now the question is, why would you reflect on this? There are beings who conduct themselves in a bad way in body, speech, and mind. But when they often reflect on this fact, the body, bad body, conduct, speech, and mind will either be entirely abandoned or grow weaker. In other words, you reflect on the fact that if all you've got is your actions, so you better act well. So if you have some bad actions in your past, you better abandon them. then on you can go on to consider further. I am not the only one who is the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, etc. To the extent that there are beings, past and future, passing away and re-arising, all beings are the owners of their actions, heir to their actions, born of their actions, related through their actions, and have their actions as their arbitrator. Whatever they do, for good or for evil, to that will they fall heir. When you often reflect on this, the factors of the path take birth. You stick with that path, you develop it, cultivate it. And as you do that, the fetters are abandoned, the obsessions are destroyed. In other words, all the obstacles in the mind to awakening are destroyed. Now, the emotion here is a little bit different from heedfulness. The term in Pali is sangwega, and it literally means, it's often translated as dismay. It can also be translated as terror. You realize that no matter where you go in the universe, you're always going to be subject to karma. Okay, even if you have a lot of good karma and you get up there where you can enjoy it, it's not going to last forever. And if you don't get out of the cycle, you can start falling down again. And so it's, these are the two emotions that the Buddha recommends most developing. One is heedfulness and the other is sangwega, for developing skillful qualities. Any questions on that passage? Yes. They're two very different qualities, actually. Okay, heedfulness, mindfulness is basically keeping something in mind. That's the Buddha's definition. And the question is, what are you going to keep in mind? Well, you might keep in mind the fact that, okay, I've got to be careful about my actions. And that way, heedfulness will then inform your mindfulness. But mindfulness is just the ability to hold something in mind. Whereas heedfulness is this active sense that I have to be very careful about my actions. I can't just act on impulse. I have to think about the results of my actions, where this action is coming from, before I choose to do something. Okay, in this reflection on karma, they actually do mean different things. Okay, like I am the owner of my actions means I actually did that. I'm responsible for it. To be the heir of your actions means you're going to receive the results. Okay, born of your actions means if you are reborn, that's going to be based on your actions. Related through my actions, the people you tend to hang around with, the people, the family you're born into, the race you're born into, the country you're born into, you tend to find groups that have similar actions. And the actions as the arbitrator that basically tells where you're going to go. So there are slight differences of meaning for each of those.
There's two spots where this differs from the translation I heard. So related to my actions instead of my actions, and then the really distant place I had heard abides for the body as opposed to the arbitrator.
Well, if you have some bad actions, they're not going to support you very well. And the word is bhatisarana. And it's not found that many other places in the canon, but the other context in which it's used, it's obvious that it's somebody who's arbitrating over another case, like a judge. There's one place where Ananda is asked, well, now that the Buddha has passed away, who is the arbitrator for the Sangha? And the Buddha says, we don't have an arbitrator, we have the Dharma as our arbitrator. In other words, we don't have a person as our arbitrator, it's the Dharma who decides. So it's basically, you know, there are some traditions that say, you know, you after you die, you go face a judge, and the judge is going to say this, that. And well, that's actually your actions. So, mm-hmm. Question in the back.
Salvation, as the goal,
how that could be read into it. Yeah. Well, to begin with, part of the practice is generosity. Well, generosity, virtue, and the meditation. Nobody's selfish or stingy or selfish ever made it to nirvana. Okay? You've got to be generous. Now, the question is, can you save somebody else? And from the Theravada position, said, if we could save other people, we'd be very happy to, but each person has to work out his or her own, basically, unskillfulness, because it's through our lack of skill that we are suffering. And you can't go out and just say, okay, here, be skillful. Or, you know, I'm going to radiate some skillfulness rays in through your eyes, that kind of thing. It's more that it's your lack of skill that's doing this. Now, I'm going to teach you the skills if I can, but you have to develop them. And so we talk, and the Buddha himself talks about, you know, there are three levels of beings. There's those who act neither for their own benefit nor for the benefit of others. Those who act for the benefit, their own benefit, but for the harm of others. There's those who act for their own harm, but for the benefit of others. And then there are those who act for the benefit of both. And it's those who act for the benefit of both, those are the highest. Yeah. Well, the question is, what does it mean to benefit others when it comes down to it? And from the Theravada point of view, you can only go so far. And from that point on, they have to carry the ball themselves. Whereas in the Mahayana, they have this belief that there are the beings up there who would be all too happy to, you know, help you all, you know, finish the way. So it's a question of the idea of what's possible and what's not possible. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Just curious, what the Pali word for heedfulness?
Heedfulness is appamada. A P P A M A D A. And part of the answer to your question is going to be answered in the next section. Okay. Okay, now we're going to start on karma and causality. I hope that the fog of your meal has passed, so you can give your undivided attention. Okay. As I said earlier, the Buddha's teachings on karma were distinctive in his time. And there are basically three qualities that made them distinctive. One was he speaks of the mind as an active principle. It's the mind who's making the choices. It's your choices you're making from within, your own consciousness, that these are going to be the things that shape your reality. The second principle is that karma is equal to your intentions. Your intentions are what determine the quality of your action. Now, those intentions, in turn, are based on views. And at the same time, they're informed by reflecting on your actions and their results. So they're not just good intentions, they become skillful. So when you judge the result, when you judge the quality of an action, it's both the intention and the result acting together. And then finally, the causality that underlies the relationship between actions and the results is complex. The Buddha's own description of this principle of causality, he calls it this, that, or this conditionality. He calls it that because it actually is pointing at things in your direct awareness. The causal factors for your suffering, that's something that's in your, well, the suffering itself is in your direct awareness, and the causal factors are in your direct awareness. Now, the thing about direct awareness is that it's something that you have and you cannot share with anybody else. There was probably some point in your childhood when you realized, you know, the blue that I see, is that the same as the blue that my friend sees? And how are you going to take it out and compare? There's this aspect of your awareness which is totally yours, which you can't share with anyone else. Suffering is an issue within that. And the blue or not blue is not that big an issue. We kind of think about it for a bit and say, gee, isn't that weird, and kind of shrug it off. But our suffering is something, well, again, that lies within that range of our awareness. You know, I can't take my suffering out and show it to you. I can talk about it. I can show all the symptoms of suffering, and you can sympathize. But there's no real way that you're going to know my suffering. And the same, I can't really know yours. It's something each of us experiences ourselves. what's radical about the Buddha's teaching here is he said that we're suffering because of things that are also on that level of awareness. And this is why you can't go in and cure somebody else's suffering, because the causes are things that they're experiencing from the inside. And fortunately, the way to solve the problem is also done from the inside. You know, there's that book titled Happiness is an Inside Job. Well, suffering is an inside job too, but the happiness can be done through an inside job as well. So these are factors, he's saying, that come from within, that are experienced from within, so, and then can be cured from within. Now, in terms of your intentions, the expression of this, that conditionality is this. When this arises, that arises. When this passes away, that passes away. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. From the passing away of this comes the passing away of that. Now, you listen to those, and it sounds just like two different ways of saying, okay, things cause something else to happen, and then when they stop, then it causes the ending of other things. But it's actually saying it in two different ways. The first one is, when this is, that is. When this isn't, that isn't. Okay, this is basically talking about things that arise and pass away at the same time. In other words, here in the present moment, if this arises, this is going to arise with it. And here in this present moment, if this passes away, this is going to pass away with it. So they exist together and they don't exist together. And we're talking here about what's called synchronous causality, i.e. right at the same time. The cause comes, the effect comes, and then at the when the cause goes away, the effect goes away. The other one, from the arising of this comes the arising of that. From the passing away of this comes the passing away of that. That can be causality over time. I'll give you an example. You put your finger, for the synchronous causality, you put your finger on the stove, it's painful right away. You don't have to wait until the next lifetime. You take it off, it feels a lot better right away. Okay? Now, there'll still be a little bit left over. That's causality over time, if you burn yourself badly. Another causality over time would be you plant a seed today, and you know, 3 months later it sprouts, even though you know the planting and the stopping of the planting stopped. The conditions go on, and finally the plant will arise. And so he's saying basically that our experience is the combination of these two principles. Now take that one step further. That means at any one point in time, what you've got happening is present causes and present effects, plus effects coming in from past actions. And that's what our experience of any one moment will be. Now, because you have many different past actions, you have many different potentials coming in from the past, and it is best to see them as potentials, because as the Buddha gets into analyzing it, what you've got is potentials coming in from the past that your present choices will actually actualize. And so like you're sitting here right now, you have different parts of the body. There's a potential for pain in some parts of the body and a potential for pleasure in other parts of the body. And whichever ones that you focus on, whichever ones you get involved with, those are suddenly going to become more and more real. And this is just one type of example. And so what this means is that, where am I here? You've got a complex system. Because it's not just, you know, A causes B causes C, but there are also other factors coming in, because you have many potentials coming in from the past, and you have many choices right now, which could be free. I mean, as we were talking last night, the question of free will is that we don't really exercise our free will that much, but the more conscious we are of the choices we have, then that expands our range of how we're going to exercise free will. Now, because it is a complex system, it shares some things with complex systems in general. Have you ever seen a Mandelbrot set? There's one in the book. Did anyone take a copy of Wings to Awakening? Yeah. Could you hold that up? Ever see those things printed back in the 90s? That's called a Mandelbrot set. And you make a Mandelbrot set, it has a very simple equation, but you, what they call, iterate it many times, and it becomes very complex. You get this extremely complex pattern. And this is what's happening in our lives. Things aren't just, you know, little wheels turning around. There's lots of complex things coming in and going out. One is that there are complex patterns, but because the it's simple patterns to begin with, but because the simple patterns iterate, they get more and more complex. We also have feedback loops. There are two types of feedback loops. One is right here. If I took this mic and I put it in front of the speaker, that would be called a positive feedback loop. A little sound goes in here, it gets amplified through the speaker, comes back into the mic, gets amplified through the speaker again and again, and we have to leave the room until they cut off the speaker. Okay. And it's called positive, not because it's something positive, but it just intensifies the reaction, intensifies the result. Another kind of feedback loop would be the thermostat over there on the wall. When the heat gets up to a certain level, the thermostat turns off the heater. When the level of temperature goes down, the thermostat turns it back up again. That's called a negative feedback loop. And that, okay, it keeps things kind of in balance. And this is basically our lives. We have some positive feedback loops and some negative feedback loops. And it can drive us crazy. But at the same time, we can actually learn how to use it to our advantage. Another feature of complex systems is what they call scale invariance. If you ever had a little zoom through a Mandelbrot set, you would notice there's this Mandelbrot bug-like pattern. And if you zoom in on parts of the pattern, you'll see the bug appearing again. And then you zoom in on those, and you see the bug appearing again. And what this means is, you can think in terms of erosion. Suppose you took a picture of an erosion pattern without any context to tell you how large it was. You wouldn't know how large it was, because erosion patterns on a small level are the same as they are on a big level. I mean, you could be looking at a little tiny pile of sand, or you could be looking at the Grand Canyon. And it's basically the same patterns going over and over again. How this relates to the practice is actually what's going on in your mind in those little levels of becoming that we talked about earlier. Those are the same things that go on in the big levels of becoming, like taking a birth in one level and then dying and then going to another level. It's the same process, just written on different scales. One other problem of complex systems is they're extremely unstable. Anicca, writ big, inconstancy, it's extremely unstable. Because all you have to do is tweak a little something and the whole thing can go haywire. You probably heard that thing, a butterfly flaps its wings in Hong Kong and it brings down a jet liner in San Francisco. I've never heard of that actually happening, as far as I know. But the possibility is there, because it's depending on so many factors being in such a particular way, it's very unstable. This is why, from the point of view of the Dharma, the lives we have, because they depend on a complex interaction of things, this is why it's not a basis for true happiness, is because it is so unstable. Another aspect of complex systems is what they call the arrow of time, which is that in a complex system, when it goes through certain changes, you can't unwind it and make it take it back to where it came from and then wind it up again and get the same result. Because each time, because there are all these other aspects coming in to the present moment, it'll shift it this way and shift it that way, and you cannot wind it back. From the point of view of the practice, that's good, because once you've gotten in front of your defilements, nobody can come back and give them back to you again. And then finally, this, what they call, the system can be collapsed from within. In other words, by following the rules of that particular system, you can actually take the system apart entirely. They talk about what's called the three-body problem in physics. Basically, you take, for example, you have the sun and the moon and the earth, and you try to calculate the orbits, and based on the gravitational pull among those three bodies, there will come a point where the speed and the interactions of gravity are such that the moon will leave its orbit around the earth, and you cannot predict where it's going to go. Mathematically, basically what happens there is that some of the equations that describe what's happening, you get something that's divided by zero. And when something gets divided by zero, it's kind of out of the system entirely. And so that's symbolic for using intentions of karma to get to something that's beyond karma. That's where that's relevant to the practice. When I was talking about this in France, it turns out one of the scientists who was mathematicians, excuse me, who was most responsible for discovering the three-body problem, Poincaré, turned out that one of the people on the retreat was a big fan of Poincaré, and so he showed me a video of what Poincaré had done. It was pretty cool. There was this king from Sweden who was concerned. People had begun to realize that there was this possibility that given the way this solar system is put together, it might collapse. And he was kept the king separate. No merciful God would ever allow the solar system to collapse, okay? So he wanted a mathematician to prove that God would not allow the solar system to collapse. And he offered a prize. So whether the mathematicians believed in God or not, they were going to go for the prize, because it was a lot of money. And so Poincaré did the calculations that, yes, the solar system was stable, sent it in, won the prize. And as they were about to print it, the editor of the journal said, wait a minute, there are a few mathematical errors in your equations. We want to send it back for you to clean that up. Well, it sent back to Poincaré. He cleaned it up. And the more he cleaned it up, the more he realized, wait a minute, I've just proven that the solar system is unstable. And he had the integrity to tell the king, okay, I'm going to send the money back. Not only that, I'm going to make sure that none of those journals ever get printed. So that's one of the features of a complex system, as I said, is that following the rules that keep the system together, you can also actually take the system apart. If it hits a certain kind of what they call a resonance, where things get repeated again and again, and at some point in the equation, some part of it gets divided by zero. Then you're out. So you can see the implications of what this has here, that we can follow causality, we can make use of causality, but if you do it in a particular way, you can actually use causality to get us beyond the system of causality and beyond the instability of that system. When I was teaching the retreat in France, one of the questions that came up is, you know, it's going to take the moon many millions of years to get to that point, and I don't have time. And I said, my response was, the moon doesn't know what it's doing. You know what you're doing. You can actually aim your actions in a particular way to get out of the system. So that's sort of the general features of complex systems. If you have any questions about those now, ask them now before we move on, because we're going to be building on this. Yes?
Well, I just wondered
if by moving
out of the system,
you're talking about freedom. Exactly. Freedom from rebirth, freedom from suffering. That's moving out of the system. Yeah. Merit would be, okay, it depends on your intention for doing meritorious things. And if you want to stay in the system, but in a comfortable way, okay, then you can continue doing the things that would keep you in the system. But you have to realize that even though it's getting comfortable, the comfort is unstable. Now here you are up in the Pacific Northwest. You came here because you knew that the weather is cool and rainy, and all those nice trees are going to give you shade. And things happen, you know. Now it's dry and it's hot. And guess where it's cool this year? San Diego is cool. So. I know a family that built a large home on the seafront in Florida. Because Florida has low taxes for wealthy people. And I asked them, well, what are your preparations for, you know, the sea level rise? And they kind of looked around. And they said, well, if we go, everybody's going to go. But I said, well, why go there to begin with? I mean, so merit is good, but it's unstable.
Stable system, that doesn't mean you're in guaranteed stability.
Well, Well, in this particular case, the Buddha got there and he said, yeah, it's stable, because you're outside of space and time. Mm-hmm. And once you're outside of space and time, nothing's going to happen.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Put it on my to-do list.
Yes. Not yet. No. We're working our way up to it. Okay.
All right. Okay. And for something to happen, it has to have a duration, which would be time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
outside of space and time, there's no duration. Mm-hmm. There's no unduration either. It's just our concepts start bringing down there. They get to the surface of that, or they get to the edge of that, and they pull back. And it's only when you reach arahantship that you're fully there. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to continue with the remainder of this talk. I didn't realize how long this talk was going to be. We're going to be here all afternoon. Okay, that's complex systems in general. There are specifics of the Buddha's teachings on complexity. For one, with dependent core arising, which was Barbara just pointed to as passage 15. We're not going to go there yet. I'll just give you some general background. Notice that when the Buddha talks about these processes as they happen, he doesn't give a context for them. He doesn't say this happens in the world on a large scale, and it doesn't happen in the mind on a small scale. That's not written into the end of the description. And what happens is it turns out that it happens on all different scales. It's the same process. In other words, the connection, say, between fabrication and clinging can happen instantaneously in one mind moment. It can happen over a long period of time. It can happen from one lifetime to the next. This can happen on many different scales. There are certain feedback loops that are written into dependent core arising. One of the most prominent ones is that consciousness is a factor for craving, and then craving is a factor for consciousness. We're talking here about consciousness and the six senses. So they feed on each other. And as long as there's one, there can be the other, and that means you have to learn some place to break the loop. But it turns out that you can bring awareness to any part of the sequence and undo the whole thing. Because sometimes you hear, well, it's the link between feeling and craving that's the important one, or other links. But actually, the Buddha says that you can bring your awareness to any one of these factors. And because it's a loop, once you cut the sequence at one of those factors, the whole thing falls apart. Now, within dependent core arising, all the factors are part of your direct experience. As I said, the part of your experience that you don't share with anyone else. And there are many factors that come prior to sensory contact. And those are the ones that determine whether or not we're going to suffer from that contact. In other words, you can have a pleasant contact, but if your mind is primed to suffer from it, you'll find some way to suffer. You can have unpleasant contact, but if your mind is primed not to suffer, this is the good news. You don't have to suffer from it. That's what we train for. And when we start looking at the factors of dependent core arising, you notice that sensory contact is halfway down the list. We've got all these other things leading up to it. Things like intention and perception and consciousness, fabrication. And these are all the attitudes that you're bringing toward the contact. And those are the ones that determine whether or not you're going to suffer. So you can listen to that and hear good news, or you can listen to that and hear bad news. We're trying to make it good news. In other words, you're not a slave to what's happening around you. It's your habits or your skills that you develop can determine that you will not suffer. Both of these points are actually good for the purpose of putting an end to suffering. On the one hand, if the factors were not part of your direct experience, you'd have to depend on somebody else to come and undo your suffering. This is the Mahayana view. there. They keep saying, well, there's something out there that's causing you to suffer, but something out there will come and help you. Whereas from the Theravada point of view, okay, the causes are in here, but they can also be solved from within here. Okay. And as I said earlier, this the fact that if your suffering were determined by the contact, we wouldn't put an end to it, because there are all kinds of contacts in the world. So, now, as dependent arising specifically relates to karma, karma is directly related, part of dependent arising, in two of the factors. One is called fabrication, which is really early on in the system. If you look at passage 15, right after ignorance is fabrication. So karma comes right after ignorance. And the other factor which relates to karma is what's called name, under name and form. Because under fabrication, first you have three kinds of fabrication. There's physical, verbal, and mental. Physical fabrication is your in and out breathing. Verbal fabrication is your direct thought and evaluation. And then mental fabrication is feeling and perception. I'll go down the three. Okay, your in and out breath, that's the part of your physical experience that you actually have some intentional control over. Not only the fact that you breathe in and out, but the fact that you have this breath quality in your body, that's how you can move it. That's kind of how the mind moves the body. It's through the breath. Verbal fabrication, directed thought and evaluation, as we explained earlier, that's the way you think as you're talking to yourself. Now, if you've ever read any instructions on meditation, you hear about directed thought and evaluation being factors of jhana. You direct your thoughts to the breath and you evaluate it. You're talking to yourself about the breath. And then finally you have perception and feeling. Perceptions are the labels you place on things, which can either be words or sort of visual concepts, images. And that can range all kinds of things. I mean, something as simple as microphone, recorder, clock, just the word we have for these things, those are perceptions. And also we can have kind of mental images. You see your boss and something in your lizard brain says, enemy. Or whatever, you know. Those are also perceptions. And these things have a huge influence on how we're going to perceive contact when it comes in. Now, because you can have some control over these things and you learn more control over them through the concentration, because you've got, especially when you're concentrating on the breath, you've got all three kinds of fabrication right there. You've got the breath, you've got your thoughts about the breath, you've got your perceptions of the breath, and when you think in your mind, okay, where is the breath coming in? You may have an image of the breath entering or out, going someplace else. That's perception. And then there's a feeling, and you can learn how to tweak those things so you can have a really pleasant feeling. Okay, if you're doing that well, you can walk into a really bad situation and it's not going to scare you. Or people will say horrible things and it just goes right past, because you've got everything together right here. But if your breathing is labored and uncomfortable and your perceptions are running all over the place and your chattering in the mind is out of control, you walk into a situation and you're going to suffer. So this is one of the reasons why the Buddha focuses on breath meditation as a way of getting rid of the ignorance right there as quickly as possible. This is, we're talking about both verbal and pre-verbal levels. So this is one of the ways you bring knowledge to that link to break it. And that's all that fabrication then becomes good karma. The other karma factor, which I said is name under name and form, and it actually has the five qualities. Two of them are in common with fabrication. You have feeling and perception again. You also have intention, attention, and contact. Intention, of course, is the karma. Attention are the questions you're asking yourself about the situation, about what to do. And contact is the contact among all these things in the mind, kind of intra-mental contact. So, for instance, you walk into a room. The chocoholic comes to your house. His attention is focused on the question of where is the chocolate in the house? Okay. His intention is to get some of that chocolate. He's feeling hungry for chocolate. He perceives you as a provider of chocolate, potentially. And if you don't fill up to that bill, then he's going to start complaining. Okay. Just walking into your house, okay, he's primed. Especially if you don't have chocolate in your house, he's primed to suffer. Okay. Even if you do have chocolate in his house, he's primed to suffer. So the other thing that's important to note about that this is your present karma. Present karma is the fabrication and name. Past karma refers to the sixth sense media and the contact at those media. That's your past karma coming in. And what's interesting is that if you look at the list, the sixth sense media come after fabrication and after name, which means that your experience of past karma has been already filtered through your present karma. The stuff that's coming in, those potentials coming in from the past, you've got to filter up to pick up on some things and not pick up on others. And so what this means is that your present karma is really, really important. It determines whether or not you suffer. Again, this can be good news or bad news, but the Buddha says we can train our present karma. You can't go back and change your past karma, but you can change your present karma. And this is why. This is why this has an impact on the mind, because this is what can cause you to suffer or not cause you to suffer. This is why the Buddha never talks about people deserving to suffer. I mean, his teaching is how to put an end to suffering, whether it's quote-unquote deserved or not. He said, what we inherit from the past are tendencies that will be shaped by your present karma, by the fabrication and name in the present moment. It's like a cook working with ingredients that you ordered back in the past, sometimes knowing what you're doing, sometimes not knowing what you're doing. In other words, last month you ordered for this month, and it turns out that what you want right now is not what you ordered, but this is what you got. So what are you going to do? If you're a really good cook, you can still fix good food out of it, whether it's good stuff or not. I mean, look at some of the food that we eat. I mean, I can make an example of shrimp paste, but that's not fair. Or fish sauce. And fish sauce is basically the liquid that comes out of fermented fish. They put all these fish in a jar and put a lot of salt in, and then eventually the whole thing just kind of decomposes and this liquid rises to the top. They skim off the liquid, they put it in a bottle, and they sell it to you. But that's not fair. Let's talk about cheese. Cheese is moldy milk solids, you know. And yet we're able to make all kinds of good stuff out of cheese, right? Because we're skilled cooks. You look incredulous.
Me?
No. Yeah, you. Mm-hmm. You're looking incredulous. Okay. I'm sorry. Yes. Well, no, no. No, you looked incredulous about cheese.
Well, I can understand what you said.
Okay, sorry.
I didn't hear what you said.
I'm sorry. Okay, so the trick is learning to be a good cook. Stop there for a minute for questions, Brock. Well, basically what happens in stream entry is that for a brief moment there is no intention in the present moment. We'll talk a little bit later basically tomorrow afternoon we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. But what's happened is that because your experience of the present moment has to depend on your present karma, your present intentions, if there is a moment where there is no present intention, the whole thing falls apart. Now it has enough momentum to start back up again. Especially if you haven't totally cut to ignorance, you've just had that glimpse, but then you get pulled back. And part of it's like touching the deathless, but not being able to go in, because there's still something that you know. Or you notice, okay, there is a dimension where there is no time, no space, no fabrication, no suffering. And you come back from that, and it's, you know, it's unforgettable. Let's put it that way. And so that shifts the way you look at things, and it shifts your attitude towards things. Now, there still be some lapses in your mindfulness, but that experience is kind of been imprinted on you, that you've verified it for yourself, that this is really true. But it does come from this point of, there's a moment where there's no present intention, and everything just kind of unravels. And that's when you see, okay, your experience of the past depends on your present karma, your present intentions. Yes? Well, it the body, it's hard to say that there's a change in the body. But I never thought of it in those terms. Yes.
You made a brief reference to what you do to access the jhana state.
Mm-hmm. Again, we go back to those three kinds of fabrication. You've got the breath. That's the topic of your meditation. You've got directed thought and evaluation, the verbal fabrication. Okay, you're directing your thoughts to the breath, and you're evaluating the breath and evaluating how well your mind is staying with the breath. And then the third one is mental fabrication. You've got a perception of the breath and mind and your relationship to the breath. And then there's the feeling tone that you've created out of this. Now, if you are focused on the breath continually enough, just that much will be enough to get you into jhana.
One of the teachings I've heard is that if you want to get into jhana, you won't. So what I just heard you say was focus on something else.
We have focus on the breath, yeah. You're not sitting there thinking about jhana, 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 jhana. You're thinking about breath, 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 breath.
Okay,
yeah. But in the back of your mind, you're saying, keep coming back to the breath, coming back to the breath. And why are you coming back to the breath? Because I want to get concentrated, okay?
Right,
we're getting into right concentration. And I mean, that's what we're doing in the morning with a guided meditation. Focused on your in and out breath, direct your thoughts there, evaluate the breath, and then the Buddha talks about, okay, wherever there's a sense of well-being, allow it to spread through the body. That's getting you into jhana, if it's solid enough. Yes?
I'm very puzzled by reading 12.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly I'm puzzled by the first part, and then I'm puzzled about how third and fourth parts of it sort of seems to be going into the third and fourth noble truths,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
I can't recognize the first and second.
Okay, in this passage in 12, just to give you a preview, okay, he's basically making the distinction between old karma, i.e. past karma, and present karma. Your present experience of old karma is your eye, your ear, your nose, just your tongue, your body, your senses, basically. This, your experience, this stuff out here you're experiencing, this is past karma coming back at you. Okay. And then the new karma is what you're intentionally doing right now. Now, what he doesn't get into the fact here is that what you're doing right now is actually shaping what you're experiencing out there. It's in the dependent core rising that he gets more into that these factors of fabrication and name. And if you look, you know, this, you've got the six senses in dependent core rising. They're fairly far up. Okay, that's your past karma coming in. But you've already, prior to that, you've got your present karma is already churning up. How are you going to react to?
Okay, so
react to things.
It's not the sense organs themselves, but it's what I'm getting to the sense organs.
Mm-hmm. And because past karma has a lot of momentum, because there's a lot of habits that you're bringing with you. But this is why, where you're going to train yourself in new habits, where you train yourself in the present moment. And what you do right now will be tomorrow's old karma. So you work on today. This is why it's a gradual path. Because there are skills that you've got to develop. You've got to kind of store up some good past karma. So as things come up, you know the right questions to ask. You know the right way to do things. Yeah, it is. But what it's also saying is that past karma does not totally determine things. Because you've got the choice in the present moment. I'm going to do something different this time. I'm going to relate in a different way. And again, you see this while you're sitting and meditating. You find yourself in a thought world. You can say, I'm going to pull out. I don't have to. I know where this thought world is going. It's one of those old movies that doesn't even star Greta Garbo or anything. It's just but I've been watching it again and again. But I can just cut it. I've got that choice. And the more you emphasize those choices of pulling out, the more you're going to see.
Could I equate intention with wanting something and not wanting something? Like making a discernment. Like if I pay very close attention, it's like, I want this, I want more.
You're choosing what you want, basically. There's a choose. And again, it's like something's being offered. Do you want this or not? And then you choose yes or no. Well, there comes a point, and this is why the mind has to be extremely concentrated to get to that point of no intention. Because you can see, okay, if I choose this, I'll have to go there. But it's suffering on both sides. And for most of us, it's either going here or staying where you are. But there come a point and you realize, okay, there is a third choice. I don't have to do either. And you don't say, I choose to do neither. You just say, you just don't choose. And if your mind is properly balanced, that's what opens it up. But to get there, you've got to do good concentration practice. That moment where it's divided by zero.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we'll talk about what that means a little bit more tomorrow. It sounds like we're speaking in code right now. But yeah, okay. Anything else before we go on? Yes. Okay, it's a peculiar thing. It goes way back in Indian, the word name. Okay. It goes back to early Indian philosophy when they say basically that an object is an object and then we put a name on it. Okay, so you've got the form of the object and then the name is applied. And then they got to the idea that a human being is also form and name, but the name here is something different. It's not just a name that's applied from outside. It becomes its mental faculties. And so basically you could equate name with just mental events. And it's kind of the mental processes that go into naming things anyhow. You have to perceive it. There are things out there for which we have no name at all because we don't really have any use for them. You know, like what's the name of that space of grass between a sidewalk and a street? You know. Okay. Canadians have names for it, okay? In America, you ask that question, everybody's like, you work for, okay. Okay, that's because you have some desire around that you have to have a name for it, right? You know? Okay. But there are a lot of things that for which we have no desire, so we just don't have names for them. If you don't pay attention to them, if you don't have any intentions around them, you're not going to have a name. So you can see how attention and intention got related to this concept. It's better to just call it mental events, though. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you are going to
Yeah, we will, yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't quite catch it all, but I'm very interested.
Yeah, Okay, now before I finish this little talk here, got a couple more concepts to cover. In the Buddha's description of his complex system, there are three kinds of complexity. The first one is the complexity of new karma itself. You have intentions that are caused by contact. They are shaped by attention and perceptions, which can be views. These things could be shaped by past karma, but they don't have to be. The fact that you have consciousness allows for the opening for free will so that your knowledge will have an impact on your actions. This is the principle of feedback loop. You see something happening, you can immediately decide what you want to do with that. If you didn't have consciousness, you would just be like a little machine. There'd be no feedback loop. But the fact that you're conscious allows you to see, oh, I don't like that, you can make a shift. You can change things. So it's your attention, intention, and perceptions working together around things. For example, you're sitting here meditating and you're suddenly thinking about what you're going to do tonight. And a part of you realizes, wait a minute, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing here. I'm not supposed to be thinking, planning about tonight. I'm supposed to be thinking about the breath. Okay. Then you remind yourself of what is my intention for being here. And you say, originally my intention was to be with the breath, but now I think I'm going to change. And then you have to sort of firm up that intention again. So, no, I'm going to be with the breath. So the question is, what do I do? What do I pay attention to? I pay attention to the fact that I would much rather come away from today saying I actually meditated all day rather than I was fantasizing about my meal tonight. And then you perceive being with the breath as a good thing. All of that is present karma. And that brings you back. That's an example of the complexity in the present moment. There is a complexity in the interaction between your old karma and your new karma. The problem is that karma ripens at different times. It doesn't always give its blatant results immediately. So some, as I said, some things you do now, you're not going to see the results for another month. You may not see the results for another lifetime. I mean, if karma were the kind of thing, like you do something wrong, bang, lightning comes down, nobody would misbehave, you know. But you've got some old karma that's going to take a long, long time to ripen, and other old karma that will ripen in a day or two. So you have all these different potentials. There's a phrase you sometimes hear that say, if you want to see a person's old karma, you look at their present condition. That's not true. You can't see their old karma just by looking at them in the present, because they may have all kinds of karma. The image the Buddha gives is of a seeds planted in a field. Some of the seeds are ready to sprout. Some of the seeds are not going to sprout for a long time. Some of the seeds will sprout if you give them water, but not if you don't give them water. So you've got a more complex relationship. That's one of the complexities. Second complexity in the interaction between old and new karma is that you've got the filtering of your present sensory input. And the mind filters things coming in. Like those kids going by just now. You could have chosen to pay attention to the kids and you could start complaining about the noise, or you could just be saying, I've really got to hear what Ten Jeff has to say, so I'm going to listen really hard. You filter things out already. So the same potentials, but you filter them in a different way. And finally, you get the importance of the mind state while doing the act and while receiving the results. If you read the passage on the lump of salt, that's what he's talking about. It's that your mind state while you're doing the action is going to have an impact, but also your mind state when you're receiving the results will also have an impact. If you're in a foul mood and something bad happens, that's just going to add more or more unpleasantness to it. But if you're in a really good mood and someone comes up and they insult your mother, you say, you poor thing. And it just goes right past you. And finally, given that there are so many actions in the past, you have many potentials that could shape the present. You have no single karma account. As I said, that phrase about you want to see a person's past actions, look at their current condition. It's like we have this one karma account, and what you're seeing is the running balance. But that's not the case. You've got many, many accounts there with all those many seeds. It's more like we have a diversified portfolio. Okay, so what happens as a result of all this is that the Buddha is not justifying the status quo, and he never talks about people deserving to suffer. He says, okay, you've got all these potentials in the past, but if you learn how to handle things properly in the present moment, you don't have to suffer. There's always a large element of change that can be brought into the present moment. Now, sometimes you have some past karma that no matter how great your mind state is, it's going to come. But you have the choice of suffering or not. And it's about time for a break. Do we have any quick questions before the break? Yes? Okay, well, there's two kinds of suffering. There's suffering in the three characteristics, and the suffering in the Four Noble Truths. Suffering in the three characteristics is the fact you've got this body that's going to grow old, or is growing old, and it's going to give you pains here and difficulties there. And that's, fortunately, that is not the suffering that weighs the mind down. No, the suffering that weighs the mind down is the suffering based on craving and clinging, which is the suffering in the Four Noble Truths. Okay, we'll meet back here at 3. I'm told that there was a cafeteria upstairs if people want coffee.